Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, so much Computex. Intel's Core i9 CPUs, 18 cores, people. HP, Lenovo, and Asus are building Snapdragon 835 Windows 10 machines and a 200 megahertz ultra-wide gaming monitor from Asus. All this and more is coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 417, recorded June 1st, 2017. Intel strikes back. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that brings you the most engaging, most delightful, and occasionally even most affordable hardware news, reviews, and pro tips around. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton, joined as always by Mr. Ryan Schrouts from PCPer.com. Are you excited with all of the Computex news?
Yes and no. Yes. No, right, I mean, it's
excited.
There's a ton of stuff here.
Yeah.
There's a ton of it out there. And like, I love seeing churn. I love seeing things happening and things being released and all that. I do kind of dread what the summer months will be like in terms of workload. Right. But I guess that kind of comes with the territory. But in general, I assume the more news, the more if we have to cull stories from the show notes every week, that's a better place to be in than if we're stretching to find things on a weekly basis.
And it's funny because Computex has been very like, oh, obscure motherboard. Let's talk about some products that will never meet the U.S. But it's been some big announcements, including what I kind of think of as the shot across the bow, right, with AMD's kind of grabbing the enthusiast community with a great big giant bear hug in the last few months, going, yes, we'll give you incredible multi-core performance for practically nothing compared to Intel. Intel Core i9 has been announced, 18-core Skylake X, Kaby Lake X, and the X299 chipsets. These are their new high-end desktop processors, and I feel like these may have been hastened along a bit by the successful launch of AMD's Ryzen lineup. So,
yeah, no doubt. I think that's definitely the case, and I would even go as far as to say that the left half of that table that we're slowly scrolling down to was pretty much determined directly by AMD's releases, right? So, these go as high as an 18-core hyper-threaded, so 18 cores, 36-thread processor called the Core i9-7980XE that has a sweet price of $1,999, and that is not $19, that is $1,999. The reason that part exists is because last month,
Threadripper.
It is June, yeah. Last month, Threadripper was announced, and they said, AMD made a big deal, and I think warranted at the time that we're going to have a 16-thread part. The highest end, the highest core count consumer processor from Intel at that point was a 10-core CPU. Mm-hmm. So clearly, this was all a result of AMD's kind of aggressiveness there. And I would even go the pricing has been adjusted even of the existing set of parts here as well. So take, for example, that 10-core processor, the 7900X, the Core i9 now, 7900X, is a 10-core 20-thread part that exists currently as the 6950X on the Broadwell E platform. That launched at $1,700. The 7900X will launch at $999. So a $700 reduction in the cost of a 10-core 20-thread part, and the clock speeds on the Skylake X version are higher. So you're going to get a better performing part than you could 1 year ago for $700 less than you could. And that is, don't get me wrong, $1,000 is still pretty expensive for a processor. But in terms of the benefits of competition and of pressure from competing companies and fears of market share loss, like that is what you get, is you get these reductions in prices that, mm-hmm. Intel had extremely high margins on these parts before. Now they're going to have still pretty high margins, just, a little bit lower. The other really interesting part there is the 7820X, which is mm-hmm. the 8-core 16-thread, and it's $599. The importance of that is that it kind of goes up against the 8-core Ryzen 7 family of parts that peak out at the 1800X. Those are 8-core, 16 threads. They start at $499. And before today, before this announcement, the lowest cost 8-core part that Intel sold was like $1,000 or $1,100, right? So you're getting another $500 or so reduction. In an attempt to more closely mimic the pricing structure that AMD had gone with. And again, you got higher clock speeds and all that type of stuff. So, you know, it'll be interesting because now when these processors launch and we have to reevaluate the status of, you know, that $600 CPU, $600 to $500 CPU, you look at the Ryzen 7 1800X versus this. Mm-hmm. Single-threaded performance, Intel's still going to be ahead. And then multi-threaded performance, it will be close. But now rather than saying, you know, AMD has a $300 or $400 or $500 advantage on pricing, now you've maybe only got 100, maybe 150, depending on what the Ryzen prices kind of settle at. So now it totally resituates the discussion.
I mean, I think it was, you know, it's in some cases like a 1700X is maybe 20% down over what it launched at. I think it would depend on what week you're shopping and where you're shopping, but that's a pretty big reduction.
I think it's also odd as I look at this table that mm-hmm. Intel felt the need to have an 18, a 16, a 14, and a 12, and a 10, and an 8, and a 6, all in this kind of family of parts. That's maybe too many processors, and we don't know the frequencies for all of them. Those are going to be kind of in the July, later in the summer timeframe. The two at the very far right are interesting in that they're Kaby Lake parts. And this is the first time that Intel's ever launched more than one kind of like micro architecture on a platform like this at the same time. If you look really closely, the Core i7-7740X and the Core i5-7640X are very similar to the Core i7-7700K and i5-7600K, which exist on the LGA 1150 socket, right, today, the Z270 chipset. These are quad-core hyper-threaded and then quad-core non-hyper-threaded. They're frequencies are a little bit higher, but not very much, maybe 100 megahertz. They still only have 16 lanes of PCI Express. Their TDPs are up there, but their prices are pretty much in line with their Kaby Lake equivalent. So the 7700K sells for like $350, $340. The 7740X is supposed to sell for about the same. So Intel has basically created these parts to... Again, having not gotten like the actual briefing from Intel on any of this stuff yet, is basically like the X299 platform will be a thing. There will be really awesome motherboards that are based on this, and we want to give people as low a cost entry point into that platform if they want to do that, with the option to upgrade later, right? Like you buy a quad core part today for $242. If you hit it rich sometime down the line at the casino next month, you can spend $2,000 and move your way up to an 18 core part if, you know, your workloads and your wallet decide that that's the best move for you. So it's really interesting to see this because there will be a lot of questions, and I think valid ones, about why do these Kaby Lake X parts even exist, since they are essentially duplicates of parts that already exist for the Z270 chipset. But it's hard to complain about too many options, right? You know, if you don't like those, buy the other one, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to complain about too many options, but then on the other hand, we ran into the situation like last spring where we were looking at 132 new motherboards across three manufacturers, because like every manufacturer had 30 to 34 different motherboards coming out essentially for the same chipset. So you know, it's great to have all of the niches covered, but at some point, are we driving excessive confusion? Are there that many options?
Sure.
Or maybe it's just that easy for them to bin sort and package this stuff so that they have every possible price point covered, and giving them that much more room.
I agree with you on that, because I think the audience that wants a 14 or 12 core processor but doesn't, you know, want the 18 cores, probably pretty limited. Like I don't know. We talked about this last night, like the person who's sitting there looking at the 7940X and says, 14 cores, 28 threads for $1,399. But if you really need that much threading horsepower, you're probably and you're already spending $1,400 on a processor. What's $1,700? What's $2,000? Right. Like I do think that there are too many parts here, but I could see it seeming odd if they went from like 10 core straight to 18 or something like that as well. So it's, I think the easy answer is just, I don't know, put them all out there. And if they sell them, great. If they don't, we can bring them back in and respec them and use them for our own internal systems or whatever you're going to do. Right. So, an interesting launch nonetheless. So pretty compelling stuff.
Moving in a,
and that's, go ahead.
No, after you.
I was just gonna say it's a like mid to late June release for those parts, like the 10 core and below. And then after that, we really don't have any clue what those are going to be. They, you know, a couple of new features. They redesigned the cache hierarchy that will, once we get hands on parts and look at performance, we'll detail into that. And then the most favorite core feature that I loved the name of, Turbo Boost Max Technology 3.0, was updated to support two cores instead of one. So now your two best cores on those higher end parts will be able to clock higher than the rest of the cores, just trying to help improve single threaded performance without sacrificing multi-threaded capabilities. So
interesting. The moving in a completely different direction, but also at Computex 2017, Asus, HP, Lenovo are going to build Qualcomm Snapdragon 835 Windows 10 machines. Now, before you say, oh, yes, it'll go so well when it's no longer supported next to my Windows RT tablet, this is not Windows RT. This is not Windows Mobile. This is not Windows Mini, writes Mr. Shroud. This is an actual, full, totally compatible, universal Windows operating system that just happens to be running on Snapdragon, Snapdragon 835. I mean, is this a pure sort of, you know, price play? Is Qualcomm trying to finally beat what last, you know, is Qualcomm figured out a way to sort of beat the last of Intel's presence out of the tablet market, the entry-level tablet market? I mean, you know, who's going to be deploying these?
So, I mean, they announced Asus, HP, and Lenovo are going to make devices, and they're not targeting tablets. They're targeting clamshells, targeting two-in-ones. They're targeting, okay, you know, like the laptops that we both use every day. You know, their shtick, their angle on this is not going to be on the performance side. It's going to be a struggle for them on you know, competing directly performance part to part against what Intel has, like in the Core M3, right, Core i5, you know, those ultra low voltage parts. But you know, the entire having compatibility for all applications makes it a fundamentally different product than Windows RT was. It has direct support from Windows or from Microsoft in terms of driver development and all that type of stuff. So I expect it to be a very robust, well built. You know, you should not notice that you're running a Qualcomm part in the back end unless you know what you're looking for. Their kind of angle is on the connectivity side. So every Snapdragon 835 processor has an integrated Snapdragon X16 LTE modem, which is capable of up to gigabit LTE speeds. So even though now that's just starting to be deployed throughout the country, the idea that every laptop sold with this hardware will have an integrated, you know, cellular ready connectivity option, I think is actually really, really compelling in terms of promoting the idea of this universal adoption of every device is just always connected. And you don't have to look for Wi-Fi hotspots. You don't have to worry about where you're at and what you're doing and those particular things. If you have cell phone service, it just works. And the other kind of angle they have is the idea of connected standby. Never really worked on Windows. The promise of when you just open up your machine, it not only like turns on as quickly as your phone does when you hit the wake button, but also right, like your email is already there. Like everything was pushed. The connected standby capabilities allowed all of your messages and stuff to sync at the same time. You know, Qualcomm has a lot of experience with that. They've optimized their processors for incredibly low power connected standby. They claim to have a 4 or 5x improvement in connected standby power draw compared to Intel's parts, right? And so that makes a big difference. And I think Microsoft has talked about, we're going to do connected standby right this time, and we have the partners in place to do this. And I think that's going to be an interesting kind of differentiator for the Qualcomm parts. Again, this is like late 2017 when we'll start to see these even start to roll out. But I do think the idea of kind of combining the best parts of your smartphone with your laptop is a really good selling point for people in that $500 to $700, $800 price range of machines, right? So they have a lot to live up to. You know, claims like here where they claim to have up to 50% better battery life. There's all kinds of questions that go with that, like what is the battery size and what are the processors they're comparing themselves to? Will Intel have 8th gen out by the time Qualcomm Snapdragon 835 platforms are ready, and what does that change? And there's still a lot for them to deal with. And eventually Intel will kind of wake up and start campaigning and marketing and building against this. And so they need to be prepared for that. But fundamentally, I love the idea of not having to look for hotspots, find a coffee shop, log into a thing where, you know, pops up a browser and you go on. Carriers need to be a little bit more proactive with their, you know, how much data you're allocated and you know, how much data do you actually get on these unlimited plans and stuff like that. But even if you're running, you know, at 100 megabits or something like that, even if, you know, the claims of gigabit LTE are kind of fanciful in your mind right now, even if your cellular runs at 100 megabits, that's better than most coffee shop Wi-Fi you're going to find.
Absolutely. And more secure.
Yeah, exactly. You're not going through somebody else's third-party service. And I just like the idea of not having to think about it. Like I forget one of the popular airports I go to, if it's San Jose or something like that, where it boggles my mind that they don't have free Wi-Fi in the airport still, right? And it's just like your airport is in Silicon Valley and you don't have free Wi-Fi. Like it's kind of insane.
They don't have free Wi-Fi there because there would be cheap startup dudes like parked in the, you know, basically sitting there scamming
in the
Wi-Fi.
Short-term parking.
In Vegas, they can have free Wi-Fi because everybody either wants to get to the casino or get home, you know.
True.
Before their house is repossessed, you know. It's a little bit different down in Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. The Asus ROG Swift PG35VQ is an ultra-wide 200 hertz display with HDR and G-Sync. This is a 35-inch 3440 by 1440 unbelievably fast monitor running G-Sync technology, and it maxes out at a 200 hertz refresh rate. There is no pricing information on this, but it will be staggeringly expensive.
That would be my guess.
You know, the ROG PG 348Q sells for about $1,200. You know, you can pick up Dell's U3415W, which is my personal favorite desktop monitor right now. You can pick those up for about $700 online. This is a flagship monitor that is going to. I mean, what kind of GPU would you recommend? I mean, would you start at like a 1080 for this?
yeah, for sure. Right. 3440 by 1440, it's 200 up to 200 hertz, and it's a G-Sync. So, you know, if you run it at 60 or 80 or 100, it's still going to provide a smooth gaming experience. But yeah, I mean, the truth is, if you're buying a probably $2,000 monitor, then you should invest heavily in your graphics card solution as well. 1080, 1080 Ti, those are probably the only two options I'd recommend. I mean, look, and you can get away with anything you want if you're willing to adjust settings on that bad boy. But this is kind of like, I'm kind of mad I didn't go to Computex just because I wanted to see the monitor. And I think they're going to demo it at E3. And I'm like, well, I'm already going to be someplace else that week. So I'm a little sad that I haven't been able to get my eyes on this display. But soon enough, I guess. And it's quantum dot based, HDR, 512 backlight zones. Yeah.
Is the HDR 10 compatible? Or do they get to?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, oh, it is. I'm sorry. DCI P3 color space.
Wow.
Yep. 1,000
That's really
nits.
Cool because so many of the HDR monitors we've been hearing about are sort of, you know, like an interpretation of HDR, a subset of HDR where HDR is. This is an actual full HDR monitor. Man, this is going to be, did they go to 200 hertz? Do they need to go to 200 hertz or are they just chasing specs at that point?
I mean, you don't need to do anything, I guess. But if the panel technology exists, you should probably do it. There's no reason to stop at 144 if you can go higher. There's not a lot of hardware that will be able to push 200 hertz at 3440 by 1440 in a lot of modern games. That's correct.
Right.
But You never know what GPUs come around the corner. And again, if hopefully people, you know, if a monitor is, especially at this price, is a long-term investment, you want to have the Windows as high as you can get it, so that when you do upgrade hardware, that you don't have to feel like you're bottlenecking yourself on that refresh rate. More is always better. Okay. If you're spending $2,000, again, if you're spending $2,000 on a CPU or $2,000 on a monitor, that's a lot of money.
You probably want to get at least 5 years out of it, and in 5 years, what we consider to be prohibitively expensive GPU performance will be like the equivalent of a 750 Ti.
Agreed.
Maybe. Hopefully.
Yeah.
Along with the, you know, the 8 cents per gigabyte SSD prices that Mr. Shrout has been demanding. Well, you've been demanding a dime, so I'm going to, you know what? 5 cents. I want a nickel a gigabyte.
Go for it.
Oh, my goodness. QNAP unveiled the world's first Ryzen-based NAS at Computex 2017. Whole new lineup of NAS devices. Pretty burly, badass-looking NAS devices. The TS-X77 series will come in 6, 8, and 12-bay models with AMD Ryzen 7 1700 or Ryzen 1500 or 1400 processors with up to 8, 16, 32, or 64 gigabytes of DDR4 RAM, dependent on the model. You know, RAID 0, 1, 5, 6, 10, 50, 60. You know, 1, 5, 6, 10, 50, 60 plus spare single, and just a bunch of disks, AES, NI encryption acceleration. It's pretty crazy because along with all of that computing horsepower, there will be a pair of M.2, SATA 6, SSD slots for hot storage, 2.5 and dual 2.5 inch, 3.5 inch drive based, depending on which model you're looking at. They all contain three PCIe 3.0, 1.8x slot, 2.4x slots, which you can use for PCI Express SSDs, 10 gigabit Ethernet, 40 gigabit Ethernet cards. This is pretty crazy stuff. These aren't going to be out until Q3, so there's not going to be too much in the way of reviews on that until then, but this is... These are not going to be inexpensive, but these are going to be extraordinarily capable boxes, you know, that will challenge anything you might build DIY, I think, at least until you're getting into the sort of, you know what I mean? This isn't enterprise stuff, but this is looking like some pretty serious hardware coming out of QNAP. Yeah, 4 gigabit Ethernet ports. These are pretty crazy. And I'm saying that with affection and excitement. and they're still kind of, they're really more consumer focused on this one. Or it feels that way. Okay. Supercharged business productivity with efficient, powerful multi-core processing. Oh, and silent fans and the ability to play audio files out through a 3.5 millimeter headphone jack. It's a very curious box. I'll be really curious to see what the pricing is on these. I suspect it will be
steep.
Yeah, but it will be powerful and probably a lot simpler than buying the same, you know, hardware and building a free NAS box.
Right.
Not to say there's anything wrong with building a free NAS box, but some days you just want to plug something in, throw the updates on it, and not learn a whole lot about the innards of, well.
I mean, the benefit of a device like this is you can virtualize it, put Windows on it, and you have another computer, right? Like, it's got that much computing hardware. If you're running a Plex server and you're doing all that type of stuff, like, that's what these, you know, servers provide you access to, as opposed to just kind of like a dummy, you know, couple of core ARM-based NAS box that is slower and you can't really do as much with. But this is probably a... couple of thousand dollars would be my guess for this kind of machine. Yeah.
It's going to be interesting to see. Update for Tomb Raider. What's going on with the Ryzen performance update on Tomb Raider?
Yeah, this is a quick one. Remember several weeks ago, we talked about the Ashes of the Singularity escalation game engine getting an update that improved Ryzen performance by I think it was almost 30% or just over 30% or something like that. Lo and behold, yesterday, day before yesterday, we just happened to see a patch pushed out for Rise of the Tomb Raider that mentioned that it was improving performance for DX12 and in particular for Ryzen CPUs. So we did some testing with it and found that we actually saw a boost on the Ryzen 7 1800X of about 17% at 1080p. And this is basically another instance of AMD and their team kind of working with software developers to figure out how do you just tweak the game a little bit to improve mm-hmm. performance fairly drastically on their platform, right? So even though the Broadwell E 8-core system only got like a 1 or 2% increase in performance, it didn't go down, and that's key. But the Ryzen was able to go up 17%. So that's a pretty dramatic jump in that 1080p gaming performance, and it's closing the gap between the Ryzen parts and the Intel parts in that one important area that AMD has acknowledged their problem in, right? That's 1080p gaming for lower price parts. Now, when you get into those Threadripper processors we'll talk about, mm-hmm. it's not really as important, because I think if you're spending $1,000 on a CPU, you're probably not giving it 1080p. There will be some that will, but I would say that's going to be in the majority. But this is the good thing here is that it's another major game title, major developer, major publisher that has acknowledged that they can do something relatively easily, I think, mm-hmm. to fix the performance deltas that exist, and they did it, right? And so our expectation would be anything from this developer or publisher going forward would be more likely to have these improvements already in it, affecting AMD's kind of stance into the future, right? So good news for them, good news for gamers and all that type of stuff. And it's just good for us in terms of understanding what these performance deltas were about.
Slowly but surely, things get better. Something that is maybe slow but sure, but a big honking leap that I'm really excited about. You know, I still don't know how to say that. AGESA. AMD's AGESA update 1.0.0.6, which I've been waiting for patiently and with great enthusiasm, will support configurable memory subtimings and clock speeds up to 4,000 megahertz. Tim's got a nice write-up on PC Per. We've been expecting this, essentially a massive update to the firmware for the AMD Ryzen processors that will, quote, improve memory compatibility and add new memory and virtualization features that have been sorely missing from AMD's new Ryzen platforms. It with motherboard partners now, and it's going to be out in the middle of June. So sometime in the next couple weeks, AGESA is the AMD generic encapsulated software architecture, and that initializes the Ryzen CPU cores, and memory controller, and the Infinity Fabric system. And they are adding 26 configurable memory options, including subtimings that were previously locked out. So memory clocks up to 4,000 megahertz without needing to adjust the CPU base clock. Basically, this means that hitting higher than 3,200 megahertz on motherboards that do not have an external clock generator will be a lot easier. This is, smaller increments for clock speed adjustments down to 133 from 266 MT per second. 2T command rates with the new updates. That'll open up memory kit compatibility. This is exciting. I am very, very curious to see what I can get in terms of performance out of the memory in my box, because people have been mentioning this to me from motherboard manufacturers at AMD pretty much since I built my box. so I am excited. So Asus and Gigabyte have already rolled out beta BIOSes for your high-end board. If you're feeling brave and excited and you want a little it's my production system, let's just put something that's mostly finished on there. Go for it and let me know how it works, and then I'll upgrade mine. So
safe.
I should do it right now. Can you hold on while I reboot? I'm going to throw a beta BIOS.
Yeah, no, sure. I can see no problems with that at all. Yeah.
Can't possibly create any issues. Oh, my goodness. Another Computex 2017 announcement from AMD. Threadripper is going to include 64 lanes of PCI Express 3.0. And were they running demos with Quad Vega boards?
Yeah, so
those crazy kids.
The 64 lanes of PCI Express, four of which have to be used to connect to the chipset if you have a chipset on the board, which I imagine most of these will, leave you 60 lanes of available PCI Express, which is obviously higher than what Intel will offer with their Core i9 parts and Core i7 parts as well. Those parts are 24 lanes and 28 lanes and 44 lanes, right? The higher end parts on Intel's stack have 44 lanes of PCIe. So this is 16 more than that. And they promise that all of those lanes will be available on the entire product stack of Threadripper. So you don't have to worry about, you know, the least expensive option having less bandwidth or lanes available to it for PCIe. So nice. The interesting thing there then is it gives you all kinds of options for connectivity, right? Like, so you can have lots of graphics cards in it. You can have lots of M.2 storage, NVMe storage. You can have 10 gig E graphics or 10 gig E network cards. You can have lots of capture cards in there. Like there's, it just provides you a lot of flexibility down the road. And the demos they showed were Threadripper running with Quad Radeon Vega Frontier Edition, which is their kind of high-end prosumer card. It's not really aimed at consumers. It's more like the Titan brand for AI developers, coders, that type of stuff. They showed it doing ray tracing in real time or pseudo real time. Just again, showing the ability to access 4 GPUs at by 16 bandwidth. You know, plenty of headroom there. And then the other demo they did was dual Radeon RX Vegas, the consumer variant, running the new Prey game at 4K at ultra settings, right? So and that one was, again, kind of show connectivity capability, but also just making sure they got RX Vegas somewhere in their press conference, if at all possible. So there's that.
There is.
So yeah, I think that's one of the places where they'll have an advantage over Intel, even though Intel announced, you know, 2 cores more than AMD did to kind of just do that one upsmanship. The PCIe right. will be interesting and it will be an advantage. It will be up to them to demonstrate the use cases for that added PCIe connectivity and what it can actually mean for consumers. So I'm excited about it. You know, 16 cores, yeah. 32 threads sounds like plenty to me. And I still imagine that we'll see a significantly lower cost from them than we do from Intel. So
the thing it was not really trumpeted, but it looks like it's going to be RX Vega graphics cards are not going to be around until July? Question mark. Like maybe the final announcement at SIGGRAPH on June 27th?
Yeah, so that seems like it's going to be the case now where the consumer Vega card, RX Vega, is now delayed until at least the end of July, coming from SIGGRAPH, which is a graphics trade show at it's in L.A., actually, at the end right. of July. It's actually, I find it a little bit interesting because SIGGRAPH is generally a professional graphics outlet, mm-hmm. not a consumer graphics outlet. And kind of in general, the response to this news was very negative just because AMD had been talking for a long time that Vega was going to be here by the end of June. Vega was going to be here by the end of June. And technically, they're not wrong because the Vega Frontier Edition cards will be out on June 27th. Right. So by the end of June, but the consumer variant, the one that, you know, the gamers have been waiting for, that the Reddit subreddits have been looking for is was delayed again. So now we're looking at another 60 days before launch and, you know, either it's going to be available that day or to be available shortly thereafter. So 60 plus days until availability of this product that people have been waiting and waiting and waiting on since mid-December. Mid-December is when we had right. the first kind of like small architectural reveal of Vega. So that's a long time.
It is a long time.
I don't know. And
at
we'll
this
see.
Point, there are still no real announcements on there's no hard numbers or benchmarks on the Frontier, the professional GPU.
No, nothing specific yet on that. And nothing on the RX Vega either, right? So, you know, they talked a little bit about there being water-cooled and air-cooled variants of Frontier Edition, but nothing really beyond that.
Mm-hmm. That's not a lot to work with because I bet it's not done. On a lighter note, Corsair has got a new spill-resistant mechanical keyboard. Should you be worried about beering up or juicing up or watering up or coffeeing up your keyboard if you're the kind of person that spills and destroys, or as Scott Michaud writes, I wish I could say that I have yet to destroy a keyboard with a spill, but it's happened to me twice. Once was it? This is This is painful, Scott. Once was a bowl of soup and a Logitech G15 as I was writing a paper for college. Although that only really broke the backlight controls. The other time was a bottle of water on a Razer Black Widow Ultimate, which completely wrecked it. That said, 2 in 32 years isn't too bad, right? Right? Well, I still haven't killed a keyboard with spills, and I'm going on 46. So I'm thinking, Scott, keep the soup away from the keyboard, man.
Look, I'm with them. I've yet to kill any keyboards myself either, but I will say, like, I'm one of those people that eats at their desk, right? Like, I get lunch and I sit at my desk and I watch videos while I eat lunch. That's my lunch break or whatever. And so, like, I have the breadcrumbs and stuff in my keyboard that is disgusting and gross, and I have to clean it out and I hate it. But I could see myself spilling crap on my keyboard. That's true.
Well, so this is, you know, you do not want to submerge this, right? It's IP32, which means dust and spill resistance. Like, objects larger than 2.5 millimeters, dripping water. You know, do not think you can go park your truck on this.
Good idea.
No, I say this because I worked with somebody once and they wanted to do a really cool video. And I said, you know, this is a Panasonic Toughbook, not a Panasonic throw it off a third story garage onto a concrete driveway, which is basically what they proceeded to do. And then complained because it, you know, was designed to survive a 6-foot drop and didn't survive a 30-foot drop. But, you know, the 2 and the 32 is dripping water when tilted at 15 degrees. So vertically dripping water shall have no harmful effect when the enclosure is tilted at an angle of 15 degrees from its normal position. So 2.5 minutes for every direction of tilt. Water equivalent to 3 millimeters of rainfall per minute, which basically means you can get this thing wet, you can get it dirty, but don't leave it wet for long. So Cherry Onyx red switches, which are nice, full keyboard rollover. It's good stuff. It's good stuff. It'll be $99.99 at Corsair's website. And I got to say, they are spraying the snot out of that in the video at Corsair.com. So maybe I'm underestimating the tenacity of IP32.
Better under than over.
Well, every time I start digging through the IP, the IP specs, it just gets more and more confusing, and less and less penetrable. So, oh wait, here we go. IP32 water spray. Yeah, you know, it's back to impenetrable again. Not quite as impenetrable as IP32 specs. NVIDIA's GeForce GTX Max Q design notebooks. What's going on here?
So this is a, I'm trying to figure out what I even really want to dub this. The Max Q design notebook is a initiative inside NVIDIA to make gaming notebooks thinner, more attractive, quieter. The idea is, as you can see in that kind of side-by-side there, the then and now comparison is that they want to make gaming laptops that are under 18 millimeters thick, that are 5 pounds or less, they have 3 times the performance of a previous generation, and they can utilize up to GTX 1080 GPUs. Now, the comparisons they're pointing it to here are the GTX 880M, which came out in early 2014. So you're talking about a 3-year gap, essentially, in what they want to do. The idea is great, right? Just NVIDIA is saying, right, okay, we're going to help our partners figure out ways to optimize GPU efficiency, optimize power regulation, cooling capability, in order to get you as much power as possible into that small area without, you know, killing your battery life, without having fans spin at 60 dBA, you know, those types of things. And they showed off one demo unit, which was the Asus Zephyrus, Zephyrus, which is an interesting name, I guess I'll say, that is 18 millimeters. It's got a GTX 1080 in it. You can see in the design there that it's built differently than a normal laptop, though. Notice that the trackpad is off to the right. The keyboard is right at the front of it. There's no like wrist rest type of thing. And that area behind it, between the keyboard and the screen, is clearly where your hardware is, right? It's clearly how do they get this height restriction is they kind of move things around. And it's not a small laptop, right? If it has a keyboard and a trackpad to its right. All the hardware is going to be underneath that kind of blank space between them. And that's how you can, you know, you don't have to worry about your wrist getting warm. They can do different things on the cooling on that side. They have the entire 18 mil thickness or whatever it is, minus the display, 15, 12 mil to have the GPU, have the heat sinks and heat pipes and fans do all that, do all the work they're going to do. The general idea here is that they're taking the GPU specifically to their peak efficiency point on its kind of like performance curve. If you look at a performance curve, it'll show, you know, this kind of inverse hockey stick type thing where if you can get more performance, but at the cost of more voltage and heat, and it kind of becomes diminishing returns as you move farther to the right. The idea is that they pick the point of highest efficiency, not of like peak perf. The result of which is that a GTX 1080 in this design will perform lower than a GTX 1080 in a bigger laptop. Like GTX 1080s have already existed in gaming laptops since, you know, the middle of last year, really.
Right.
And they have performance level X. NVIDIA tells us to expect 10 to 15% less than that on these machines. And I've heard from a couple of places, maybe a little bit even more less than that, closer to 20, 25%. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a sacrifice, right? They didn't magically fix everything where suddenly you're getting the full perf inside that thermal envelope. Now they are helping by kind of tweaking the GPUs and design aspects of it a little bit. But if you look at, you know, the Razer Blades and the MSI Stealth series that they, you know, had last year, like they're already gaming laptops with discrete GPUs in them, GTX 1060s and maybe 1070s that are in or around that 18 mil or below spec. So this is not a fundamental redesign of gaming laptops. It's I kind of equated it in my write-up to what Intel did with Ultrabooks, which was people were already making thin and lights, just not enough of them and not at the cadence and improvement of development that Intel wanted. So they said, all right, you know what? Screw it. We create Ultrabook. You have to meet these specs. You could do whatever you want, but you have to meet these specs in order to do that. And it became a brand and it pushed the industry forward in terms of building thin and lights. I think the same thing will happen here, right? NVIDIA basically said, look, you guys are doing your thing. It's great. We're going to take that and kind of set them in spec, and then we'll make Asus and MSI and Razer and Acer and all those guys compete to get below that spec and then improve things in a different way. So I feel like Max-Q design is kind of that same initiative as Ultrabook. What kind of success it will have, I don't know. I'm curious. We won't have the first one until basically the end of this month, into June. And we'll see, you know, do the noise specs that they claim, like, hey, we're targeting less than 40 dBA on this, plugged in or not plugged in. We'll see it. We'll see if they live up to that. And if we think the, you know, whatever cost premium there is for these kind of designs is really worth it. But, you know, I'd like to see it be the case.
As would I. Oculus has added Chromecast support to the Gear VR. Pretty simple. You can now stream VR experiences to your TV using a new cast button on the Oculus mobile app. In the words of I. Robertson from TheVerge.com. And it's an interesting movement because I was just talking to, actually, and I'll talk more about this next week, some folks from Dell about their sort of enterprise VR. And one of the interesting things going on there is creating immersive environments where you can sort of green screen behind someone or have a screen behind someone where the person playing the virtual game, you will see on the wall behind them, you know, a third person view of their in-game experience. And it's kind of amusing to see something not quite the same thing, but that you know, Oculus is already trying to figure out ways to, for everybody else in the room, to have something to do while you're wandering around and tripping over the coffee table or wrapping the cable around your legs while you're playing a game that no one else can see. So, you know, I like it. I think it's a smart move. Something worth keeping an eye on.
It's a neat idea.
Apple Echo, essentially, All right, you see, my version of this was Apple's going to build their Echo competitor. That seems to be the rumor is that it may show up at Worldwide Developers Conference. Bloomberg suggests that the company seeks differentiation with surround sound and Apple Music. So both people who use Apple Music will be able to use it on their dedicated speaker playback box. But yeah, it's a Siri controlled smart speaker. I don't think it's any more complicated than that. Supposed to show up. They could debut it at the developers conference. But generally speaking, the rumors, the sources say it will not be ready to ship until later in the year. So maybe an announcement at WWDC and shipping in time for the holidays. So virtual surround sound technology and, quote, deep integration with Apple's product lineup. So we'll see. And probably a center for HomeKit. So
cool.
We will find out. And in kind of a cheerful, couple of cheerful notes, couple of cheerful nerds notes. I love the title of this Gizmodo article. Fans of cheap drugs and printer ink just won big in the Supreme Court. This is the Impression Products Incorporated versus Lexmark International, a 7-year-long standoff between a small business and an international corporation that stood to upend the world of consumer rights, especially for technology and pharmaceutical companies. And shockingly enough, writes Adam Clark Estes at Gizmodo.com, the little guy won. This was a pretty crazy patent case. Impression Products was buying used printer cartridges, refilling them and reselling them. And if you've ever bought printer cartridges, you know why there's a market there. Lexmark got irritated by this, started suing small companies based on a little tiny piece of peculiar patent law. Impression, bless their hearts, refused to settle, fought it all the way to the Supreme Court. I'm just going to read this straight from Mr. Estes' articles. In a quasi-unanimous decision, the Supreme Court ruled that Lexmark exhausted its patent rights as soon as it sold printer cartridges both domestically and abroad. This is going to be big for aftermarket sales. I'm sure also, not just printer companies, but a lot of organizations and drug companies are freaking out right now. Lexmark was basically saying they had a shrink wrap license. They could pay, quote, 20% less for the printer cartridges if they agreed never to resell or reuse them after they'd opened the package. It just got weird. This is a big deal. And I'm kind of excited, and drug companies are really upset because this is going to complicate their ability to protect U.S. patents abroad. Mostly so that they can prevent Americans from buying the same exact drug in Canada or Mexico and bringing it back over the border. This is good. I don't know if I'd quite call it the Citizens United of products, but there's a lot of intense stuff going on right now with patent law that impacts, for example, or just law in general that impacts whether or not you will be able to repair things you own without having to go to the dealer, for example. But good article, Gizmodo.com, link in the show notes. And I am just still excited that I don't have to register my drones as long as I use them for non-commercial purposes. Just wanted to lay that out there. It's delightful.
Cool.
So, any major things you can tease coming up next week?
He scans the office. Not in particular that I can say yet. No, there'll be stuff. We got some phones in. We're testing an external graphics dock. Cool. On laptops and desktops, so we'll see how that works. But, yeah, we'll have something interesting there.
There'll be something. Shannon took a look at System 76, their Galago Pro Linux laptop this week. I got a pick for the ultimate desktop USB charger. It turns out Anker now has desktop chargers that go up to 10 USB ports. Lineage OS, which has taken over CyanogenMod. I did a review of Antlion's And of course, the microphone did not make it back to my desktop. Antlion does a really, really cool microphone you can attach to any set of headphones, because most gaming headsets sound kind of awful. But if you have a set of headphones you really, really like, Antlion's Mod Mic 5 is a really cool way. Ah, there it is. Really cool way to turn any set of headphones into a gaming headset or a Skyping headset or any other kind of headset you need. And it's like magnetically attached, and then it does omni and unidirectional modes. So you can check out a review of that on youtube.com/techthing. With that, ladies and gentlemen, we want to remind you that twit.tv/twitch is the place to go for all of our older episodes and information on how to subscribe. And you can reach Mr. Ryan Shrout. Well, first of all, go to pcpro.com. And second of all, at Ryan Shrout on the Twitters. I'm at Patrick Norton on the Twitters. You can find me at, techthing.com, T-E-K-T-H-I-N-G, when I'm not hanging out and talking with Ryan about hardware. And we want to thank you for making the time to listen to the show this week. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.